Welcome to Elements of Styles, the business podcast that trades in scarce thinking for community, conversation, and ideas in abundance. Each week, I, Mark Styles, sit with professionals and entrepreneurs, both local and global, and learn how they each add value to their communities, their partners, and their teams. Please enjoy. Hey, what's up, everybody? Mark Styles back. Today is a special guest. Special to me because I've known him for a very long time. In fact, while I was a first-year law student and he was a general practitioner in the city of Boston, he was kind enough to let me come in and work on some of his business and pay me a fee for doing that, even though I had no idea what I was doing. And I was able to learn a lot about the general practice of law. Since then, and it's been a while, so we're not going to age ourselves, but it has been a while, and I am now 25 years in as a practicing lawyer, and Larry has pivoted his practice as a tax master to facilitating 1031 exchanges. So we are going to talk a bunch about 1031 exchanges. So financial advisors, pay attention. CPAs, pay attention. Closing attorneys, this is a good one. Pay attention for purposes of talking to your clients about some of these wonderful opportunities that are available through the 1031 exchange process. So without further ado, we have Larry Blacker. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you for having me.
It is a pleasure, and I do appreciate you giving a kid who had no idea what he was doing the opportunity to come into a law firm and figure out what a HUD-1 settlement sheet was. And I think we were using typewriters and pencils and erasers back then before all this beautiful software tech came into play.
Appreciate I think you're right about that.
No, I know I am. I tell stories when I'm teaching the continuing ed on 1031 exchange and I bring you up. I talk about it all the time. You handed me a blank settlement sheet and I was tasked to balance it with a pencil and an eraser and then give it to the executive assistant who would actually type it up. They would type up the loan documents with the blank forms, interest rate, names, dates. And boy, have we come a long way with technology, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
So tell us, Larry, your company's name is what?
Newport Exchange Corp. Been in business I've been doing this for almost over 30 years. Started to do exchanges before there were any regulations. The regulations came out early 1990s, and it has grown significantly since it started. And I would say in the past 5, 6, 7 years, it has really blossomed to a huge amount of 1031 exchanges that Newport has handled and other companies have handled.
So you were doing these while practicing law at the same time?
Yes. Didn't do a lot of them because it wasn't that popular. You know, it wasn't easy to do. When I say it wasn't easy to do, think about trying to do a two-party exchange. Where are you going to find someone that has property that you want, that wants the property that you have? It was almost impossible. So it was done with a third party. You found somebody who had what you wanted and what the other person wanted, and we all sat at a table at the same time and did an exchange. And there were four-party exchanges and 5 and 6 and 7, and everyone thought that they had to be done all simultaneously. And then a case came out, case of Commissioner versus Stocker, where Mr. Stocker exchanged real estate that he had to a big company called Crown Zellerbach and said, "Don't pay me for this. I will tell you over a period of time to buy me different properties, and you'll buy them and give them to me in my exchange." He had given about $5 million worth of property to Crown Zellerbach, and over, I want to say, a period of 5 years or thereabouts, Crown Zellerbach bought property that Mr. Stocker asked and deeded them to him. And he treated that as an exchange. Commissioner of Internal Revenue Service didn't like that. So they brought a case saying that that didn't constitute an exchange. And the court held that it did. And that's when the 1031 exchange business really came into play. And that's when shortly thereafter, regulations set forth the manner in which using a, quote, qualified intermediary, which is what Newport Exchange is, to facilitate exchanges.
Got it. So back with that lead case.
Stocker versus the commissioner.
Got it. the entity that would now become a qualified intermediary was Crown Zeller?
No, they were just a purchaser. To be a qualified intermediary, the regulations set forth what you have to be. It really can be almost anyone. It can't be the lawyer for the taxpayer. It can't be his accountant. It can be his banker. And it sets forth some things to make you an independent person. And if you qualify, then what happens is that in this exchange process, the intermediary is not considered the agent of the taxpayer, and therefore it is not deemed that the taxpayer, in fact, just sold and bought property. It's an exchange through the intermediary.
So just to simplify that, we have a third party independent of everybody involved in the transaction that the IRS has, quote, qualified.
Yes, the IRS doesn't formally qualify them, but if you pass the muster under the regulations, they will allow you to be an intermediary.
So basically, you can be qualified so long as you are not disqualified.
That's very true, Amaya. It's sort of, rather than saying who is, it's the regulations actually per se, who can't be.
Got it. And okay, so you are a qualified exchange handles the exchange of assets, right? That's one thing we have to be clear about, right? So,
well, it used to be the exchange of assets up until a year ago. 1031 now solely applies to real estate exchanges only.
Gotcha.
And in order to utilize 1031, that which you are exchanging has to be real estate used in a trade or business or held for investment. It's not your residence. It's not property that you buy, fix up, and sell, because that's not being held for investment. That's being held for resale.
A flip.
And yes, a flip is a good example of that. And the property that you buy also has to be held for investment or used in your trade or business. So we're just dealing with real estate for investment or used in your trade or business. So if your business requires a warehouse, so you want to exchange one warehouse for another warehouse, that's okay, using your trade or business.
Do you have to prove that you're paying rent to another entity for that?
No. In that case, no. The business that owns the real estate may or may not be paying rent because it's one and the same.
Okay, so the one that we see most often, Larry, is where somebody has to identify three properties and close on one property. So let me back up for our listeners. They have a property that's held for investment or for their business, right? And I always take the position of you're collecting rent, right? Your business is the business of collecting rent, right? So you're a landlord. This is one that we most commonly see with the real estate professionals. So you have a landlord who owns a three family, but wants to take advantage of their appreciation over the last 10 years and not pay taxes yet, but then buy a six family in a neighborhood that has better rental income and occupancy rates. How would they go about doing that?
They start by finding a buyer for the three family. They enter into a purchase and sales agreement. After the purchase and sales agreement is executed, they contact me at Newport Exchange to say, I want to do an exchange. And Newport will enter into an agreement with the taxpayer. That's who I'll call the person that's selling. Wherein the taxpayer agrees to exchange his property, the existing three family, for property to be designated later. Closing date comes. I contact the closing attorney beforehand, let them know that this is going to be an exchange. I send them instructions on how the settlement statement should read. I send them a form that the buyer needs to sign, and I send them wire instructions. Newport gets the funds, not the taxpayer.
And they cannot touch any, or else they're going to be taxed right then, right?
That is correct, and I'll go into a little more detail on that, but that is correct. So now what happens? The closing date comes. In theory, the taxpayer deeds Newport the property, and Newport deeds the buyer the property. That's in theory. That just sort of illustrates the flow. In reality, because the regulations say so, the taxpayer deeds the property directly to the buyer, just like a regular transaction. For the form signed by the buyer at the closing acknowledging that this is a 1031 exchange, the buyer has no idea and couldn't care less. All he wants to do is own the property at the end of the day, and he does. So now that closing takes place. Within 45 days from that date, the taxpayer must designate in writing, and I have a form I sent him, up to 3 properties of any value that he might consider utilizing in the exchange. They don't have to be under agreement, but obviously they have to be properties that he has a reasonable expectation of putting under agreement.
Right.
He must close on one or more of those properties within 180 days from the day that the 3 family was sold. What happens then? He goes, he finds the property to buy. He enters into the purchase and sales agreement. He assigns the purchase and sale agreement to Newport Exchange.
Yep.
The closing date comes. Newport notifies the closing attorney, advises the closing attorney that Newport will be forwarding funds to the closing attorney. How much? All the funds that he got on the front end.
Yep.
And if additional money is needed to purchase, the taxpayer either comes up with the money or comes up with financing. At the closing, again, rather than the deed coming from the seller to Newport and Newport to the taxpayer, the deed goes directly to the taxpayer.
Right.
And that's how the exchange happens. It's not like we have to find 2 people that have what the other person wants. In my 30 years, I've only done 3 two-party exchanges, and the documentation is simple for that, but it doesn't happen very often.
And that's like a swap. I want your house, you want my house.
Exactly. It rarely ever happens. But as I said, in 30 years, I've done about 3 of them.
And that's what people thought that the regulation was allowing, was the only way to do it would be to trade.
No, before the regulations, that was the only way. Before the Stocker case, that was the only way to do it. At least it was thought.
But yet, even in a swap like that now, I mean, there's taxable events if you don't do it correctly. So if I were to say, Larry, I love your house in Naples, you love my house in Boston, but your house in Naples is more expensive than mine, right? There is still a potential depreciation. There's still a potential capital gain. There's still all of that has to be dealt with unless you're utilizing a qualified intermediary, correct?
Not in a two-party exchange. There is some documentation that you need to establish the difference in prices.
Yep.
You're getting, we're getting a little afield here only because I got to go over to one more area so people can understand this.
Let's do it.
In order to defer, first of all, it has to be, again, investment property. And my single family home in Naples and your single family home in Boston may not qualify for 1031 exchange to begin with. But leaving that issue out for a moment, what you have here is a deferral of tax.
Right.
So if you had a potential $200,000 gain on this 3-family house, and your taxes could run you $40,000-$50,000. If you do an exchange, you defer the payment of that tax. Until when? Till you sell the replacement property, unless, of course, you do another exchange. And if you keep on doing exchanges, you may never have to pay the capital gains tax. The 3-family house sells for, I'll make up a number, $500,000 after deducting broker's fees, legal fees, Newport's fee, stamps, excise stamps, etc., you need to buy replacement property at an equal or greater value.
Which is the like kind definition, right?
No.
Okay.
That is not the definition. That's not the, this is just numbers. I sell for 500 net. I need to buy for 500 or more.
Okay.
Because if I only buy for 400, I've got $100,000 of cash money available. The IRS says, well, you can afford to pay taxes.
Right.
You have money. In theory, an exchange leaves you in the same position you were. The only difference is you have different property. And you have no ability to pay taxes because you have no money.
Or you've pushed the chips further in and you've bought more, right?
That's correct. Or you bought more. And that's okay, too. Like-kind is less important now than it used to be when you could exchange personal property. In real estate, like-kind is as follows. All real estate is like-kind to every other real estate. A three-family house is the same as a shopping center. A two-family house is the same as vacant land. A strip mall is the same as an office building. All real estate is like-kind to every other real estate. If you're selling a three-family, you don't have to exchange it for another three-family. All real estate is like-kind to everything else. In the personal property area, which is not applicable anymore, it was very technical as to what constituted a like-kind property.
So could you purchase, I mean, could you sell a $400,000 three-family and turn around and buy a $600,000 investment condominium?
Yes.
So long as the rents are the business, right?
No, there's no business. There's no business. There's nothing to do with business. That's held for investment.
Okay. But you have to rent.
I said you don't have to rent it. That's not true either. I could buy vacant land for investment and there's no rental value.
And it qualifies?
Like-kind property. Property has to be held for investment. That's one category. Or used in your trade or business. That's another category.
Huh.
The gas station owner, he owns the gas station.
Yeah.
That's used in his trade or business. He doesn't hold that for investment. He can sell that and exchange, I say sell, he can exchange that for a three-family house. You can exchange it, property used in a trade or business, for property held for investment or used in a trade or business. Two categories, both are interchangeable.
So I was always under the assumption that it had to be utilized in a landlord sense, where you had the way to declare that it was trade or business would be that you were collecting rent as part of the
business. You don't have to be, it doesn't have to be your trade or business. Most people, not all, but certainly many people, a person is an accountant by trade. That's his trade or business. He also owns a three-family house.
Yeah.
That's not his trade or business. He collects rents. It's an investment.
So how do you define held for investment then?
Well, the typical would be, yes, collecting rents is good evidence of that.
Okay.
However, I could buy vacant land that I'm holding for investment because I believe it's appreciating and going to appreciate significantly in value. I could buy a two-family that's vacant, and I could leave it vacant for 3, 4, 5 years and do nothing with it, but I think the neighborhood's going to get great. And someone wants going to want to come along and knock it down and pay me $1 million because of the land. But I don't want to be a landlord as such. But I think that the opportunity for this property is wonderful.
So you could
it's just evidence of what's an investment. If I bought that same rundown house, fixed it up, and sold it, doesn't qualify. That's not held for investment. That's held for resale.
Got it. Or if I decided I'm going to move into it 2 weeks after I bought it.
That's correct. Now, if you moved into it 5 years later, that's a different story. That would not disqualify that which you had at the time of the exchange. But because at the time of the exchange, it was held for investment. That was your intent. What happens 5 years later doesn't change what your original intent was.
Okay, so let's take that example for a second. Three family, you've been a landlord. You don't really love being a landlord in this neighborhood. Mm-hmm. You do the exchange. You sell your three family. You hire a qualified intermediary, Newport Exchange. They act as the – would you say that you act as a fiduciary in that scenario?
Well, you're not. You're not a fiduciary. You're not his agent. Although I'm holding lots of money, and I do treat it as a fiduciary responsibility.
But you can't.
Exchange I'm handling, the money goes into a separate account at the same bank, but it goes into a separate account.
So you that's basically because you can't be an agent, therefore you can't be a fiduciary.
Right. That's correct.
Got it. Okay, so you hire the qualified intermediary. They handle the asset transfer. They handle the money because you as taxpayer cannot touch the money. They deploy that money into a beautiful condo on the beach. And yep. They rent it. And the intent is to rent it. But lo and behold, it's a great place to retire. So 5 years, 7 years down the road, they haven't visited that property once since bought it, and they decide we're going to move into it. That 1031 may have qualified at that time, but if they live there for 5 years, that hasn't fully converted to a primary residence, or has it?
Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's until that property gets sold that there's a taxable issue.
Got it.
To be raised. The mere fact that you, quote, convert it from investment to personal doesn't trigger anything.
Unless you sell it.
Unless you sell it.
And by this example, we purchased this condo. We rented for 5 years, never having gone there in Naples. And then after the 5 years and a day, we live there for 5 years, and then we say, you know what, I want to go to the mountains. I'm going to sell this. You haven't eliminated that tax by virtue of living in that property, correct?
That's correct.
However, if you die, what happens?
If you die, you... Under current law, you get what's known as a stepped-up basis.
Okay.
The basis is what's used to determine gain or loss. And basis is very simple. It's the purchase price minus depreciation taken over the years, plus improvements, a new roof, new heating system, minus the depreciation on those items.
CapEx.
So... if I buy something for $500,000 and I allocate and I do the depreciation thing, and let's assume over a period of 5 years I've depreciated it by $50,000. So now the basis is $450,000, and I sell it for $700,000. I have a gain of $250,000.
Right. Where most people
50,000 of which was based on depreciation, and 200,000 is quote unquote real gain.
And that's where the sticker shock happens, because most people are thinking, well, I bought it for five, I'm selling it for seven, it's only 200.
Correct. And if you had it long enough, you could be, have it almost a zero basis in the property. So that's what determines. When you die, you get a step up in basis. So, your heirs or whoever inherits this property, their basis is $700,000. We'll assume that that's what the value is on the date of death. Now that person goes and sells the property the next day for $700,000. Sales price $7,000, basis $7,000, gain $0.
No tax.
No tax to be paid. There's an expression in this business. You swap till you drop. And there are professional, you know, realtors. I say professional realtors. You know, people that own lots of property and doing this for a long time. They're older. They would never consider selling the property because of the potential capital gains. They'll just wait. They'll die, and their children will inherit it at the stepped-up basis.
And the fact that it's probably spitting off enough rental income to say, why would I sell them? I don't need to.
Well, that's another thing. That's usually the case if you've had the property that long.
Now, let me ask you this. So here's one of the things when I'm talking to people about 1031s, because they get very anxious about the timelines and, you know, well, what if I don't identify it? And how do we go about it? Do we go after all three at the same time? Do we go one? Do we take time and figure out, you know, what do we do? And my advice, and tell me if this is good advice, is find the property that you want, lock it down subject to selling the one that you're going to exchange. And you've eliminated a lot of that so long as you follow the steps. Sell the first, move the money to Larry and the qualified, move the money back down and make sure all the assignments are done correctly. You could actually do that on the same day.
You can. I have had a lot of them that do. Although I ask that they don't do it the same day, that they purchase, let's say, 2 or 3 days later, yeah. Only because...
money.
And let me just back up and correct you in one respect.
Okay.
They don't move the money. They never touch
right.
the money.
Correct.
Okay? So we don't want them to think that, oh, okay, I just got the money, and I'll give it to Larry, and now it's an exchange.
Got
That's
it.
Not the case. So they never touch the money, and the money gets wired into their account at Northern Bank. And I just like to have a couple days to make sure that the money's cleared at the closing, because sometimes the closing takes place at 4 o'clock at night, or in the afternoon, and the money doesn't get wired until the next day.
And
if something goes wrong, you know, so a couple of days later, not a problem, if they can do that. And then there are other people, I have clients that are really in the real estate business. So they know that they can do an exchange, set up an exchange. They know they're going to find property that they want.
Right.
I mean, they know where to find it and so on and so forth. And that kind of thing. So, but yes, that's the best way to do it. They can designate, as I said, up to three properties of any value. They can designate as many properties as they want, provided that the total value of all designated properties does not exceed 200% the sales price of the original. So if the first one's selling for $300,000, then they can designate as many properties as they want, up to $600,000. Well, that doesn't work around here. I've used it a few times. I had someone selling a three-family, as a matter of fact, in the greater Boston area, and he was buying military housing in South Carolina where the units were $10,000 a unit.
Interesting.
And he sold for, let's say, $300,000 up here. So he designated 15 properties.
Interesting.
Or 20 properties, whatever it was.
Huh. So.
But that doesn't happen very often.
Right. So let's back up. So we get somebody to agree to lock down their property subject to the sale or exchange of another property. You would rather the 48 hours simply because you're flowing the money and you have to paper trail it, right, as the qualified?
That's correct. That's the sole reason for a couple of days delay. Most of my exchanges are more than that because the people don't have it. I mean, I send out a letter on the 38th day saying, hey, I haven't gotten your designated properties yet, and the client will send it in the next day or so. Yeah, I've got these. And they're not even under agreement. He's still working on it. And all of a sudden, you know, I get a P&S agreement, a month later of one of the designated properties. And that's what he's going to buy.
And he has to close within the full scale from day zero of the initial closing. He has to close within 180 days, right?
That is correct. And I've had a few that fail. We had a couple that just, for whatever reason, the title couldn't get straightened out or whatever. What happens on that front is, at least the way I structure it, is this. My fee is $13 for a typical exchange. Yeah. And selling one, buying one.
Yep.
And I don't get any money up front. I get money when the first property closes. And that fee is shown right on the settlement statement.
Yep.
And then the taxpayer, so now I have the money and the taxpayer has 45 days to designate. My agreement says, and this is basically from the regulations, that he can't get that money at all unless the following. He will get the money on the 46th day, provided that he doesn't designate anything.
And
because if he doesn't designate, then there's no exchange.
Right.
So then I give him back his money. If he designates, I tell him that he can't get his money back for 180 days because he might be able to purchase one of the designated properties,
right,
even if they get sold to somebody else, because he could buy it from the somebody else, possibly.
Got it.
So, I mean, those are pretty much the IRS regulation rules. Again, I can't be his agent. I can't be the person who says, oh, you want the money today? Okay, I'll give it to you. You know, that kind of thing.
So, in theory, that person could designate three properties to the 46th day and realize, so they close in October, they go the 45 days with three properties, realize they're not going to be able to do it on the 47th day. Their money is locked down until the 180th, and then they turn around and pay taxes from the prior year.
That's correct. If the exchange fails,
yep,
you file and assuming you've filed your tax, well, no, you don't. You wouldn't file your tax return. The 180 days, let me change that now so you understand it. The 180 days or the due date of your return as extended.
Got it.
So you really have to extend if the 180 days is going to take place after April 15th. And you haven't closed yet.
Yeah.
So, like, it's going to happen after April 15th of 2020. So the sale was really a 2019 sale. Your 2019 tax return has to be put on extension.
That would.
And if there's a good exchange, the paperwork will be filed with your 2019 tax return. And if the exchange fails, the whole sale will be reported on your 2019 tax return.
Based on the date of sale.
That's correct.
So if you're locked down, so if you close and sell in 2019 and then you don't purchase, but you don't receive that money until 2020, you're still paying the taxes from 2019.
That's correct. But under those circumstances, you would not have filed your return on April 15th. Correct. You'd extend it out to October 15th.
So what gets filed if it's a successful 1031 exchange?
A form 8824.
Okay.
The accountant prepares it. I send him information if he needs it. Most of the information is found right on the settlement statements on both returns. Some of it isn't. The taxpayer would know when he bought the property, you know, that kind of thing.
So that in essence,
there's a form that gets reported on the taxpayer's tax return, 8824.
And does that in essence just connect the dots from one basis to the other?
Well, actually, I think the form does. Yes, it does. It also does the following. The 1099 form on the sale,
yep,
is in the taxpayer's ID number, not Newport's.
Yes.
So the sale gets reported to the IRS. So the return gets filed, and the gain would most likely be shown on Schedule D. And the IRS gets the return and says, oh, I see Mark Stiles sold a property. And let's see if it's on Schedule D. Oops, it's not there. He didn't do it. But then they go through the rest of the paperwork on, oh, 8824. I see Mark did an exchange on that. He exchanged a three family. And it shows here which sold for $500,000. And he exchanged it for a six family that he bought for $700,000. Okay, that's the end of that.
And then it continues anew under the new asset that's being depreciated and the basis is now continuing.
Well, that's another thing. Okay. Nothing's easy.
No.
So now you exchanged a property, you've exchanged a $500,000 property with a basis of $300,000. For a new property at a cost of $700,000.
Yeah.
So you put $200,000 more money into the deal. The basis of that property, the first $500 of it, is the same as the basis on the old $300. And the additional money you spent, that basis is what you paid, $200,000.
Got it.
The $300,000 continues to be depreciated on the same schedule that the old one was. Assuming it's residential, you depreciate over 27 and a half years. Let's assume you owned it for 7.5. You depreciate that $300,000 over the next 20 years. The basis of that property, the new $200,000, gets depreciated over the new schedule of 27 and a half years.
And that's up to the CPA to break those out and check how it's being done.
Correct. Yeah. And they would know that.
So, Larry, what I'm seeing with these 1031 exchanges is in essence, the ability to, for lack of a better term, borrow money from the IRS with a no term, no interest rate loan.
That is true. That is true. If you sell and buy X dollars, the tax gets taken out of the pot.
The tax that you would have otherwise had to pay. So if you sell your $500,000 property and you had a gain of $200,000, there is a certain big chunk of money that you would have to pay the IRS before you'd turn around and be able to buy another property. Therefore, they're letting you use that money to buy something more, right?
That is correct.
Why are they doing that? Why was this first initiated?
Oh, you really want to get into philosophy here? Okay, let me tell you why.
Yeah.
Which is, I don't understand it as the law is now currently shown. When you could, I'm a trucking company.
Yep.
I own trucks. I buy a truck for $10,000. I deliver goods for 4, 5, 6 years. The truck is really beat up. It's worth nothing. I need a new truck. I go to my truck dealer and says, how much is a new truck? He says, oh, new trucks are now $12,000. And I say to him, how much will you give me for my old piece of junk truck? Mm-hmm. And he says, I'll give you $2,000 as a trade-in.
Yeah.
That's an exchange. I exchanged a truck and $10,000 cash for a like-kind vehicle, another truck. For the exchange rules, he, the trucker, would have to pay taxes on his $2,000 gain.
Yep.
Makes no sense. It's a truck. He hasn't changed anything. He has no money. It just keeps him in business. Avis Rent-A-Car, Enterprise, they all exchanged. They didn't sell their vehicles. They sold their vehicle to buy another vehicle.
Right.
It made excellent sense there. A trade-in is an exchange under the old law. Airplanes, Boeing, you know, the Delta, they own an airplane. Again, they depreciate it. They've had it for 30 years. They go to the Boeing and they say, what will you give me for a trade-in? And that was an exchange. Those don't qualify anymore. Now, when it comes to real estate, and I am definitely, not expressing the opinion of people who are in this business, I cannot figure out for the life of me what the rationale is for real estate exchanges. Well, I can understand it, the warehouse for a warehouse. Mm-hmm. I can understand it for real estate used in your trade or business. The gas station, the whatever, the corner drugstore, who wants to exchange that for a different location. I understand that. But exchanging a three-family house for a shopping center, I haven't figured it out for the life of me.
Well,
how's that for arguing against my business?
Well, the reality is, if it doesn't make sense, it doesn't make sense. And whether you're working through that and within the bounds of the law, that's fine and dandy. But
correct. And maybe there are people out there that explain the economic merit of this, because many tax provisions are set up for economic stimulus.
Right.
Now, maybe this would be people wouldn't sell investment property. People wouldn't upgrade. And maybe that's true. And maybe that's the basis for it.
Because the way I've looked at it, and as I've shared with you and talked to you over the last couple of months, because I've been teaching a continuing ed course on this, my view of it is it's almost a private-public partnership where real estate investor, we want you to continue to be successful and provide housing stock for the rest of society. You're good at it. We want to incentivize you to do more of it, create more housing stock and provide better housing for those that can't afford it. So we're going to get behind you. And rather than ask you to slow down and pay your taxes now, we're going to support you, defer that tax, let you use that money so that you can provide more housing stock. Whether it makes you wealthy or not, well, that's okay. We're going to let you do that so long as, you know, the societal benefit is that you're providing good. And I know it doesn't relate only to residential real estate, but for most of the folks we're talking to, it is. And you're there providing a needed service, which is to provide housing for people.
Well, Mark, the only thing I'm going to say, I would agree with that to the extent that I exchange something for something that I build.
Yeah.
So I add to the stock. Letting me exchange a three family for a six family, I haven't added anything. But the same nine units are out in the world somewhere.
Unless you're creating value in those units.
Well, that's possible. I may upgrade the units and that kind of thing. And that's true. I mean, so there are certainly some subtleties. And again, maybe the concern is, but for this, nobody would ever sell real estate.
Right.
You know, they just hold it till they die.
Right.
And then they're tired, and therefore the housing stock goes down because they don't maintain it.
Right.
Because they don't have the new blood to come in and take over. So that may very well be the reason. That may very well be the reason.
Well, I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. I wanted to ask one more question. And now we know that we've got the three, identify three within 45 days, close on one or more within the 180. What happens if there's this screaming deal that shows up in front of you that it just fell apart? You have to buy it right now. You have to buy it in 48 hours and you don't have time to sell your other.
Okay. That is a reverse exchange where you get control of or purchase the replacement property before you have sold the relinquished property.
Yep.
And that is doable. It's doable in one of two ways. Newport can take title to the replacement property,
yep,
park it, so-called, for up to 180 days until you sell the relinquished property.
And thus cash the equity back into the replacement.
Well, you just, you know, we just do it in reverse fashion.
Yeah.
A lot more paperwork, some certain problems doing that, assuming that you are getting financing on the purchase of the replacement property.
Yeah.
You have to have the money for the down payment because Newport doesn't have any money.
Yep.
To add to the pot. The relinquished property hasn't been sold. That's number one. Let's go over past that one and say, okay, the taxpayer's got the money.
Yep.
For the down payment. Then you have to be dealing with a bank that understands these things.
Right.
For example, you're going to get a loan of $400,000. You are, Mark Stiles walks in the bank, hey, listen, I want to buy this thing for $500. I've got $100, and I want to borrow $400. And they say, okay, Mark, I see you have good credit. Sure, well, no problem. But by the way, I'm not taking title to this property. Newport Exchange is taking title to this property. And they will sign a note with the bank for the $400,000, but he'll sign it non-recourse. Don't look to me for anything other than the mortgage property. He'll sign a mortgage, non-recourse.
Yep.
And I, Mark Stiles, I'll sign a guarantee, personal guarantee.
Yep.
Now, I'm going to suggest to you that the bank is in fine shape from a security point of view with that arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
However, it doesn't qualify for Fannie Mae mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. You need to be dealing with a commercial bank.
Right. A community.
That's where the problem comes in, doing it that way.
Right.
The other way to do it is I take title to your existing three family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a problem. Now you go to the bank, you give me $100,000, you get a mortgage, the property goes, the new property is in your name. I now hold title to the, what will be the relinquished property. And again, we've got to sell it in 180 days.
And would the bank put a mortgage on that as well?
No, what do they? No, they don't need it. They don't even know anything about it.
Got it.
When I do it that way, they don't know anything about it. It's all paperwork. It's, I buy it from you for a mortgage because I have no money.
Right.
I buy it for the mortgage is the equity. And what happens is when it sells, I pay off the mortgage. And we're not sure about the purchase price, though, of the sale price, I should say. We think we know what it is. It's a guess, but we don't know. And therefore, the amount that I have to pay you back, I may not have enough, but you'll be satisfied with me giving you all the money from the sale. And if I get too much, I can't give it to you. I go to the bank that holds your mortgage, the $400,000 mortgage, and I give them the extra $30,000 that I have, and I use that to pay down your loan. So, but yes, it can be done reverse. It's also a little more expensive.
I would imagine it's a little bit more complicated. Well, for our listeners, for both the consumer listeners, this has really been helpful. I know that there's a lot of real estate investors out there that know a little bit about these exchanges. I find it fascinating that the like kind, that term will probably go to the wayside, and everybody will start to really refer to them as they should, as a 1031. But I know that this has been super helpful for our other professionals, the financial advisors, the CPAs, the closing attorneys, real estate agents, loan professionals, and the property and casualty can all benefit with knowledge like this, Larry, and I really appreciate it. Before I let you go, there's one question I ask everybody. We're in a room. It's an icebreaker. You're asked to sing karaoke. What's your go-to karaoke song?
Oh, mine has to be a Bob Dylan song because I'm the worst singer in the world. Anyone.
Well, I was going to ask you before we hung up, what is the best way for them to get a hold of you?
The best way is just to call me.
Yep.
At 617-893-0282.
And folks that are listening and seeing this on iTunes and Spotify and all of the places where you consume podcasts, that will be in the show notes. So you can link right to it after you finish listening. So you don't have to get in an accident, writing it down, it will be in the show notes, and you can call Larry of Newport Exchange, and he can help guide you through this complicated yet simple yet super beneficial process. Larry, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks for joining us today. If you enjoyed the show, be sure to subscribe on your platform of choice for a new episode each week and share this with everyone and anyone. If you have any questions or comments or have an idea for another guest, feel free to shoot me an email at mstiles@stiles-law.com. That's M-S-T-I-L-E-S at stiles-law.com. And if you are a real estate professional, be sure to check us out on our private exclusive Facebook page, The Real Estate School at 892, for content and Massachusetts continuing education opportunities. Be well, folks.